This is an interview for Peak Magazine. We're in Granger Market with the main man, Gilliman, Newcastle, the city centre. Gilliman, thanks for coming down.
You're welcome, man.
Really appreciate it. First question is, you got into hip-hop 9 years old with the subtext of basketball. Did this go hand in hand, or was the basketball first, or was the hip-hop a natural progression from basketball?
For me, like, as a personal thing, I still can't remember whether it was the egg or the chicken. It's basically like they did go hand in hand. And again, I simply can't remember whether it was my friend Robert Wallace on the schoolyard who decided to play basketball rather than football, or whether it was the music first and then the progression into basketball from football. I can't remember which one was first, but it was very much hand in hand. The first steps I ever took were very much similar steps as far as basketball and rap music, or hip-hop as a larger culture, if you will. I've got vivid memories of getting sort of verbally abused on the schoolyard for choosing to go against the narrative and play basketball rather than football, because, you know, it was just the done thing at the time. The early 90s, you played football, so we took a few jabs for changing up and playing basketball rather than football. And at the same time, you know, it was hip hop culture was very, very quiet back then in Newcastle, so I took a few jabs for that one as well, for as far as listening to hip hop music and straying away from the norm and just being a bit different, a bit weird, especially on the estate where I came from. You know, hip hop was not forbidden, but most people like mocked it, and it was quite a bit racism as well, as far as like the older kids, they didn't like it. You know, it was like it wasn't the done thing, you know. So yeah, man, I got into DJing just strictly off my own back. I worked at KFC. I had troubles at home. I moved out. I lived with my grandma. But the condition was I had to get a job to live with her. And I worked at KFC in Wall's End. I saved up and I bought a pair of 1210s and a Championship Technics mixer from a guy from school called Sean Millen, I believe his name is. I bumped into him. Me and Rick bumped into him maybe, do you remember that? About a month ago, he had the glasses on outside of the shop near yours. And I was like, I bought the decks off you, and he remembered. So the best thing about this story is that I've still got the decks. They're still the ones that I use now after maybe what we're talking like 20 years, no, 25, 20 years maybe, 20 years. I've still got the decks now. They still work perfectly. I was bigging them up saying I've still got the decks. So I got into DJing by myself. I was just self-taught. Sat in my grandma's flat in my room and just practiced every night constantly. I was massively influenced by Juice the movie. Omar Epps' character is called GQ. He's a DJ character, and I was massively influenced by him. I just wanted to be like him, so I would just practice scratching and mixing, you know. I was already like massively into hip-hop by the time I got around to wanting to be a DJ, so it was just a matter of like wanting to do it. I was into Kung Fu at the time as well, so I would shave my head a lot and watch like Shaolin movies. So I was kind of like into Kung Fu and I was into DJing. So I would try and apply like like the discipline of like the Kung Fu movies and stuff, but to DJing. So I would sit there and DJ for hours and hours, and then I would watch my videos, my Kung Fu videos and my hip hop inspired movies. And that would be that would be my life. My grandma was very like strict as far as like she wouldn't let me bring a lot of things to the flat. She kept it simple. So I had a TV, and I had at first there was just a record player in the living room or the sitting room or whatever, and she had an old record player, and I wasn't even allowed to bring decks there. So I just had I bought my first records without having a pair of decks. I just listened to them on an old record player. And then, as I gave my grandma's trust, she let us have a pair of decks. But until then, I was just allowed a TV and a video machine and my clothes, and that was it. So that was my life, basically, just practicing DJing and watching old videos.
Cool, man. Cool. I've got to give massive props as well, because you've got a couple of artists references with Bob Ross couldn't paint a better picture.
Nice.
I love that. And
thank you.
And something about Salvador Dali, dripping Salvador Dali.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. Just like dropped in.
Make it melt like I'm Dali.
That's the one.
The time, but yeah, within the art with the time,
yeah.
The picture melting. Yeah, yeah. Well,
I love that.
I mean, I don't know. I suppose Bob Ross is just kind of like, he's amazing. He's
amazing.
Just like,
his hair's amazing. His artwork's amazing.
Yeah. He's just like, basically, when we were doing drugs when we were younger, like the come down aspect, Bob Ross was like a babysitter.
Yeah.
It's just more soothing to watch him paint.
Calm, yeah.
Just yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Hours on end.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Rest in peace, Bob Ross.
There's a young gilly man. He's lying on his bed. He's maybe 15, 16 years old. He's looking up on his wall. What's on your wall? Today I feel like tomorrow wouldn't feel right. Not until I fix yesterday. The past leads to depression, the future brings anxiety, so I'm trying to live for the day to day.
When I was 15, I was an avid The Source magazine fan, and I went fucking crazy when I was 15. I went, you know, when you see all these conspiracy videos of the guy like putting all the pictures on the wall and linking them all up string or whatever. I was fucking crazy when I was 15. I made my room into a hip-hop cube, and I covered every single inch of the wall and ceiling with A4 pieces out of The Source magazine. So I had DMX, Nas, Snoop, The Lox, fucking, you know, everyone all over the wall and the ceiling. So not only were the four walls covered, but the ceiling as well.
Hip-hop cube, I like that.
Yes. That's what I was doing, out of my fucking mind.
Yeah, so that kind of moves us on to where does Gilly Man come from? Where does that name come from?
Right, well, the whole name is Gilly Man Gyro. And I always have to like correct people because there's three names. It's Gilly, then there's Man, then there's Gyro. So Gilly came from the schoolyard. It was just an abbreviation. Everyone had a nickname, and majority of people's nicknames just went on their last name. So like there was like Adam Henry was called Henaz, Mark Ski was called Ski Man, I was called Gilly, and my original name is Michael Gill, and then like there was and then Andrew Shell was called Shelly. So it was just an abbreviation. It was a very simple sort of schoolyard name, but then when I started DJing, everyone still knew it as Gilly, but when you pick a DJ handle, my DJ handle was DJ Gyro, because I used to sign on a lot. I mean, after I'd got my decks and I was like sort of dug in, I just quit my job and I started just DJing full time and signing on. So my DJ name was DJ Gyro. One main reason was because I was signing on all the time, and because like a gyro gyrates like a deck. So DJ Gyro, and then basically when I got to my late 20s, early 30s, and I was done with DJing, you know, for whatever reason, mainly because I was taking too many drugs and getting in trouble and getting banned from clubs and stuff. I changed it up, and I wanted to rap. Like, I'd seen all my peers, like Rick and the likes of, I wanted to do more rapping, you know, because I've been a fan of rapping. I rapped when I was 10 and 11. I wrote lyrics and here and there, but I never really took it serious until my late 20s, early 30s. And then I needed to come up with a name, like as a rap name. So it was quite simple to kind of like, to merge my two well-known names together, which is Gilly and Gyro. So it was kind of like, it was the play on the African mountain, Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
So if you say Gilly Man Gyro, it's, you know, you kind of get it, you know.
Oh, that,
so that's where it comes from. It's just it's amalgamation of two of my handles, just put strung together with Man in the middle.
Of course, I've been into the hip-hop scene for a few years as well. Not as hardcore as yourself and Rick, but I used to go to like Fat Sam's, the Black Swan, and all them, all them old haunts. I just want to ask: were you there, or were you aware of those places?
No, because like you said, I'm a bit younger.
Yeah.
So when I started like just popping up on the scene, it was more like Fusion and Clear Bar and Fleet Street,
yeah,
and Northumbria University with Turbulence. Like, so around like the millennia, like when Roots Manure was getting big and stuff, and like that's when I started popping up, like maybe around like when I was like 17, 18. But like I say, I was a DJ at the time. I was attending gigs regularly, but as a DJ. So yeah, I hear stories all the time about Fat Sam's and the Black Swan and what was it, Back to School?
Back to School as well.
Yeah. I remember all them places, but I was still quite young. Mm-hmm. So my first real taste was Fusion. I remember seeing like Rick and Dialect and the Tex Defenders, the Scruffs, Stig, Ken Masters. That's where I really, you know, cut my teeth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes on to my next question, because you were DJing in these bars.
Yeah, gradually I got into DJing full time, and I would like, it was basically like me and ADS, we were like battling for the main slots of a lot of the main gigs. So yeah, I was heavily setting all these gigs. Say for instance, when there was a big gig on, book someone from out of town, it would, you know, an average set would just be me DJing, and then Rick and Dialect would be performing that night as well. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the local acts that were booked between, like I say, me and ADS and maybe Ken Masters, like we, and Blazy as well for some parts. Like they were the main DJs that were getting booked.
Not always, but another thing that can go hand in hand with hip hop is, you know, drugs, alcohol, all the temptations. Could you maybe elaborate on this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether it's like the drugs and that first, and then the music, or the other way around. But like, as hip hop is seen as an urban sort of street, city type of music, well, you know, the drugs and the drink, that's always going to be there. So again, I don't know which one comes first, but I mean, I know that I'm predisposed to being an alcoholic with like alcoholic grandparents and you know, that kind of thing. I mean, my granddad was a heavy drinker, and his family were all terribly, you know, they died terribly with alcoholism and suicide. So, I mean, I think it runs in the family genetics as far as that. My dad's side of the family, they're still alive. They're really healthy. They're still, you know, they're like a drink, but as far as me growing up in the city, I was always going to find alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. It was just a matter of time, and I was very young getting into drinking drugs. I've got quite an obsessive nature as well, so I was fully committed to taking drugs and drinking by the time I was like early teens. It was quite sad, really. I managed to get a hold of it. I managed to really sort of nail it down by my early 20s. But then I've had a couple of, you know, serious sort of cases of alcoholism over the years. Drugs, I mean, I've experimented with the majority of drugs, and, you know, I've been to some dark places, but I can manage the drugs a lot better than the alcohol. The alcohol's is my mm-hmm. crutch. Mm-hmm. But as far as the music goes, I don't know. Like I say, I don't know whether it's people who are troubled or people who live in the city who then turn to music as a creative outlet, but then get lost with the drugs and the drink, or if it's the drugs and the drink, and then they want to when they want an outlet and be creative and tell people their pain. Mm-hmm. I think it goes hand in hand. I think it's a bit of both. But yeah, I think you're more susceptible to fall victim to these kind of habits if you live in the city, and it goes, you know, the bigger city, the more likely you are to fall in this, you know. I would say as well, like, it's probably true in the stereotypical manner where the poorer the area, the more likely you are to get involved in the harder drugs by peer pressure and, you know, the availability as well. I mean, I'm not saying everyone, but that's kind of true for the most part. As far as I've seen along my journey, my experiences, my poor friends got into harder drugs overall. I'm not saying everyone, because there's definitely a few exceptions, but it's kind of the going rate.
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of same, follow-up to the same kind of question. With you describe yourself as when you were DJing in these bars as falling off? Could you? I think you've already answered the question, haven't you?
I'll quickly just. So, when I first started DJing, I didn't have a lot of money, and I would just buy what I could. So maybe it's a little bit of weed and maybe it's four cans from the shop or eight cans, you know, if I had a bit more money. But then when I started DJing, a lot of the bars, I don't think they take advantage because they give us an opportunity and a platform. But most of the bars wouldn't pay you money; they would just offer you free drinks.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I really got like heavily like hooked. Because I had no money and this was just something, you know, it was a way of getting drink. And then before you knew it, it was all about the alcohol rather than the music, and it took over. And, you know, before I knew it, I wasn't really DJing as good as I wasn't as focused because I was just drunk. Mm-hmm. And, the drugs came with it as well. You know, if you're DJing, a lot of people want to keep their coats or whatever behind the decks. They want to do drugs. So you get some lines or whatever if they want to do it behind. So, you know, it all got very, very, like, serious and a bit too much. I ended up getting barred from a couple of clubs for fighting and for being too drunk and too high. And, you know, it was quite sad. I took a step back. Like, I knew I was done as far as that because, you know, I've got an addictive personality. So when it became unbearable for, like, the promoters and the bar staff and for me, and maybe it's even for ex-girlfriends and stuff, I had to just take a step back. Mm-hmm. It was a bit crap, you know, but luckily I got over it.
You live and learn, don't you? It's like there's no losing, there's learning.
Yeah.
So. Oh yeah, did you do your first promo with Section Red, your collaboration with Section Red and how it came about?
Okay, so when I first started getting into rap, like actually like MCing, it was probably about maybe 8 years ago now, and I was late, obviously, you know, with the DJ history, but I knew everyone who was on the scene. When I first started recording my first demos, there was a guy called Nick Light who was doing videos at the time. He was kind of like one of the go-to guys for doing music videos in Newcastle. So I hooked up with him, and no offense on Nick because he's a nice guy, but you know, I did pay him, but that never got put out. There was two videos I did with him for two of the tracks which are featured on my first album. We did a video for Vampire Hunter and we did a video for Slack Tide.
I love that, yeah.
But I didn't think the product was good enough to put out. So I shelved both of them videos. And again, I did pay him, but I didn't have any qualms with him. But then he moved to Canada, and there was another guy who a couple of people up here were doing videos with, but he was more expensive. He had to come into Newcastle to do the videos, and the product he was creating was like, you know, it was better quality. It was more hip-hop orientated, and he'd already been established. So. I mean, I had a little bit of money at the time, not a lot of money, but I had enough money I wanted to make sure that my product was good. So on a video set in Heaton one day, a rapper called Hans, he was shooting a video, and he asked me to come along to show him some places in Heaton because he's from the West End. And I was friends with him, you know, at the time I was, you know, we were hanging out, and he wanted to shoot a video in the Heaton area, in the East End, and he knew that I knew the area well, so I got invited along to the set to be in the video and to show him around, and I got talking to Ollie on the set there. So from there, it became, that's where we built a relationship. I suggested we should do a video, and then from then on, we've done about 16, 18 videos together.
Yeah.
It all started from there.
A lot of stuff I've seen, yeah. It's great.
Yeah, we've got a good working relationship. Shouts to Ollie Whitehouse.
How would you describe the Northeast hip-hop scene, even if there is one, and do you collab with anyone from specifically the Northeast?
Yeah, I'll make sure I answer this first.
Introduce yourself, pal.
I'm Rick Fury, and I'm part of the Northeast hip-hop scene. So yeah, I mean, I get asked this a lot, and I always give the same answer, which is like, it's constantly changing, there's loads of people doing stuff. Some stay, some go, some come back. but there's always something going on. There is, whether you know, sometimes people disagree and go, this is shit. There's always something there for them to call it shit. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And then when it's going really good, they're like, oh, this is mint, this is world class. And then, you know, there's, you can reminisce now. There's like, well, in our case, there's like nearly 20 years of like
eras, remember that? Remember different that? Eras,
remember,
yeah.
Remember when, what happened to him? Remember when we used to get that barn? That's mad.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, it's mint and it's constantly up and down all over the shop. But personally for me, I don't know. I'm old now and I feel like it's not the same. I don't know. There's no... When we put on gigs now, we put on live gigs outside to try and capture that feeling of like, let's all get wrecked together and play some music, which sounds simple now, but it's a fucking big deal. You kind of, you know, it's... And I'm kind of stepping back a little bit, so I only know what I know. So someone could be like, oh, you're full of shit. There's loads of shit going on. I know there's a lot of younger kids, like DJ ADS still... DJs for a lot of the younger ones, and they didn't. It's kind of, from my perspective, it's all grime related, it's all a lot more fast paced, young, which is fine, that's great, it's just not the same. But again, that's what I say, it goes up, it comes down, it changes, it morphs, whatever. So, I don't know, yeah, it's good, but it's different.
Yeah,
just.
just what he said is, you know, I feel similar. I feel it's very fragmented, I think there's a lot of different scenes. A lot now, I think, with the hip-hop, shall we say, genre, it's very sub-genres now. There's like the grime, there's trap, there's drill, there's the new metal sort of aspect. There's the new school, there's like old school heads, there's like Puritans. There's people who just like the music in general, you know, like rap music. So as far as being like sort of a unified culture, it's straying further away from that every day because of the different fragmentations and the sub-genres and the I mean, I'd sort of say there's quite a, like a split, a divide between old and new now as well, like youngins and old people. I don't mind either way, I don't give a fuck. I mean, I listen to grime, it's not, I don't particularly like it that much, but I listen to it. I mean, with exceptions of people like Devlin and Ghetto, but I mean, I'm not really a fan of that music, but it's definitely came from the hip hop sort of genre. So, you know, you've got to respect it for what it is. It's just ever growing and ever changing. And again, what that brings is, there's a lot of divide, there's a lot of different cultures now, which was once just a hip-hop culture, has now branched out into so many subdivisions. So, you know, you've just got to put your stamp on what you believe and what you like and what you think. We've got an up-and-coming gig on Saturday, and Rick was just saying before, like, shit, like, not in a bad way, but he's like, three of the acts that were booked are grime artists. So it's like, and we don't even listen to grime that much, but a couple of the guys, at least we're friends with, they're putting on grime sets at a rap night, it's more, there's more grime artists than there is official hip hop artists at our gig at rap time, but it's just the way it goes, you know. There's not as many traditional rappers as there was, you know.
Hip hop is renowned for beefs and rivalries. Have you experienced any resistance with, you know, producing your music, doing videos or collaborations?
Do you know what, right? Hip hop is more fickle than people think. And behind closed doors, everyone talks shit about everyone. But at the end of the day, if you get the job done and you get your product out, that's kind of all that matters. Everyone talks shit about everyone. At some point, me and Rick have talked shit about each other. Yeah. It doesn't matter. It's like, if you're grown-ups, you just get on with it. The main objective, let's be honest, is to put your music out. And the beefs, let's say the beefs, there's no real beefs. I mean, I've witnessed some battles before and some people who aren't happy with each other. But as far as like actual beef, like real beef, there's never been a lot of beef in Newcastle, or mainly up and down the country for that matter, as far as I'm aware. There's There's not real beef. Again, though, it's competitive. It's a competitive art form. Very competitive. So for the most part, I mean, you have to be on your guard regardless, because people are going to judge you, and people are going to want to take your spot. People are going to want you to fail in order for them to succeed. I mean, if you can shrug all that off and just get your product out regardless, that's the main point. That's the main objective, and there shouldn't be any excuses. I mean, I've heard loads of stories about people trying to stop me from doing things, you know, and backstabbing and bullshit, but I've just left it at the door. Because at the end of the day, as long as I can get my shit together and get my shit fucking heard and seen, that's all that matters. I don't give a fuck. And most other people shouldn't give a fuck either, as long as they're getting theirs. And I shouldn't be a reason why other people aren't getting their shine, because, you know, it is what it is, as far as, like, if you put effort in, then you would get a lot further than sitting there and worrying about the next person, where that energy could be spent putting your product out.
Yeah. Can I say something? The people who, what I've found is, we've done it for years now, the people who talk the most do the least. So that, you know, mm-hmm. and they've got a million excuses why they would have done this, that, oh, I would have done that, I would have been, oh,
same old,
I
isn't
could
it?
Have done that,
yeah.
I was just about to do what you did, but then you did it, and then what you did was shit, so now I'm not going to do it anymore. And you get used to it. At first I used to be dead sensitive, I'd be like, oh mate, I'm sorry, like, I then you realise, like, they don't want that, they don't want you to hash it out, they just want to be able to go, you're shit, mm-hmm. and I'm never going to do anything, mm-hmm. but it's your fault, and I'm alright with that now. I'm like, is that it? Mm-hmm. I'm like, so I can crack on? I'm like, man, that's beef to me. Like, like he says, it's like, tunes out, slag it off all you want, I'm doing another one now.
Yeah, exactly.
Meanwhile they're going, I'll tell you why this is shit, and I'll tell you why he's missed a trick, and
it's like, yeah,
they still haven't released one track.
Yeah, it's always the same. It's always,
yeah,
the same.
Man,
well said. This is a spin-off to the previous question. You know, there's new crews, there's 30-year-old crews in Newcastle. I'm going to ask, why can't everyone come together and get on?
It's the same reason that a class of children can't come together and get on. It's the same reason that if you work at any job, like, if you work at any job, not everyone gets on in the fucking workplace.
Yeah.
It's just human nature. There's going to be divisions. There's going to be differences of opinion. There's going to be, you know, it's just human nature. I don't think it's a bad thing as such. I think the competitive edge of having that kind of pushes people to move forward and do the best thing they can do. But I don't even know if I would. I don't even wish that to be a thing, because I think the more unity, let's say, that is, I think that the less competitive flex that you've got. Mm-hmm. I think the more competitors on the market, then the better the product's going to be,
yeah,
regardless of age and gender and all the rest of the shit. It's like, that's what pushes it forward. And like I said before, like, hip hop's always been a competitive art form, so I think it kind of pushes art in the right direction, which is, again, like, the competitive edge breeds the creativity, which, mm-hmm. which in turn, you know, creates the best music. So
that's why I would argue that we can all come together and get shit done. The only difference is, it's the people who, like I said before, it's the people who are actually doing stuff. Doesn't even have to be like we say. I mean, within music, there's, you know, there's grime. We talk loads of musicians, and people respect each other. If you're doing something and you're productive and you're grafting and you're happy doing it, you're gonna get on with other people who are like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
In that sense, we can all come together, and we are, technically, we are all together. We're all,
yeah,
we're all grafting. We're all in the same mind frame now. It's,
yeah.
Again, it's a shame if the people who aren't, who get to critique that and go, ha ha, and
yeah,
point the finger. And I'm happy with that. Again, it's like, that's like he says, it's part of it. Being a class of 30 kids, it's going to be a couple of little knackers.
Yeah, like, and I don't know what Rick said as well. I get on more with the grime artists in Newcastle than I do with the rappers.
I'm booking them now because they're doing stuff, they're promoting stuff. They've got stuff,
yeah,
out, they're doing gigs, they're doing tunes, they're hammering videos. You know, we're gonna book them.
Yeah,
up and be,
man,
like, oh no, it's grime, it needs to be. It's, yeah, like, nah, man.
Shout out to fucking Just Be, H Man, Riser, Neo, any Dons. Fucking nice, man.
I got on.
I got on better with Riser. With a grind. I said Riser.
Sorry. Right, I'm gonna go back over here.
What I think's cool, because when we were chatting off camera, like through text and whatnot, that I think we've got a mutual friend. We've got a good mutual friend called shout out to Sammy D.
Oh yeah.
If he's watching this.
Sammy D.
And we were saying, when last did you see Sammy? Yeah, I haven't seen Sammy. And I was trying to think, when last did I actually see Sammy? And it was at a house party.
Right.
But I wasn't actually at the house party.
Right.
So he was causing a ruckus at the house party. And I was very good friends with a female who ran the party. She asked us to come down to remove Sammy D.
Nice.
And it wasn't in an aggressive way.
Yeah.
Sounds like Sammy.
Because it wasn't in like, oh, can you come down and like, you know, chuck him out? Because I actually know him, he's a friend, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I had a chat with him and he agreed to, strangely agreed to leave, and he was blind drunk.
Yeah.
Why,
yeah.
If anyone knows Sammy, when he's blind drunk, it's very hard to get through to him.
It is.
And then I eventually got him out, and then about 5 minutes later,
he's back in.
I looked through the keyhole of the door, and I mean it was, and he turned into like a medieval. He was basically trying to ram the door with a tree trunk.
Right.
Oh, nice.
Which was bigger than him.
I wasn't at that party. All
right.
I was thinking that was it.
I was the one that cut the tree down, man.
He was trying to ram the door down with that, like a 10-foot tree pole. That he must have cut down from somewhere, or I don't know how he's got it.
I love Sammy D, but he's a fucking lunatic. Right. Well, last time I seen him, I think he had blood all over a purple suit, looked like Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
And I remember one of the last times I seen him, he took us upstairs at the Brandon, and he was showing us some of his Aleister Crowley books. I've got some Crowley books, and he was showing us some mad fucking books, some real dark shit.
Right.
But yeah, shouts to Sammy, man. He was one of the first rappers, shall we say, on the scene when I was younger. Like, he was always supportive of me when I was younger, you know. He was a tour rag, he was a handful, but I always thought of him as like a Newcastle sort of skinny man or whatever, you know. He was all right, man. Sammy's all right.
Big shout out to Sammy if you're watching this, pal.
Yeah, man. Shout out to Sammy D, man.
Can't remember exactly what tune now or what track, but it seemed like there was a definite nod to the Wu-Tang Clan, like maybe early on. Obviously a huge fan. Would you cite the Wu-Tang Clan as a major influence?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. 100%. Was it you I was talking about when I thought, I went to HMV when I was a kid, and I thought it was a skate album?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, so there was a hip-hop section in HMV, and we would always go to the hip-hop section. But when Wu-Tang 36 Chambers came out, it wasn't straight away in the hip-hop section, it was in the new releases. And whenever I walked past it, I thought it was a heavy metal skateboard album. I don't know why, but I didn't really understand what Wu-Tang was for a couple of months or three. I mean, back then it seemed like a long time, like 3-4 months, but
yeah.
I assumed it was a skateboard and heavy metal album. But yeah, 36 Chambers and the first five or six releases from the Wu-Tang was hugely influential and still is. Like, on my music, you know, that New York boom bap SP-1200 MPC sound, like that's to this day, that's still what I listen to a lot, and what I like to make is very, you know, influential from Wu-Tang, Pete Rock, DJ Premier, and, you know, that kind of early 90s to mid 90s boom bap New York style. Definitely.
There was a small gig that the Wu-Tang done, and it was ODB's son.
Like,
I don't know if you've seen this, but what's your thoughts on this? Because he looks like him, he sounds like him.
Yeah, the young DB.
Yeah,
he's been schooled well, and I'm glad that he's getting money and he's doing good, because if you remember what Older You Bastard was like, he was very loose. Yeah. And it was quite worrying sometimes because you're like, you kind of had a soft spot for him. You were like, Jesus Christ, he's fucking himself up.
Yeah.
But, you know, unfortunately, when he died, it was kind of like, well, what's going to, you know, he had kids. He's got a lot of kids. But, like, it's good to see that at least one of his children's, you know, is enjoying the fruits of Old Dirty Bastard's labour by going on tour with Wu-Tang. And he, have you seen the bits?
Does he play him in the series?
I can't remember, but he recites, when he goes on tour with him, he does all Dirty Bastard's bits. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, just to add on to that, we finally got to perform on the same stage as Wu-Tang about 3-4 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we did it. We opened up for Ghostface Killah at the Riverside, which was a massive feat, a massive notch on my belt for us. So yeah, that was a good part of my hip hop career, is to open up for Ghostface Killah. Yeah, man.
Did you get a chance to chat to him backstage?
Did you? Did I tell the story?
What, were you on stage and he? Well, it wasn't backstage, but he's got an on stage story.
I got a rap on stage with Ghostface, but it's not a good story. So we did the gig, everything's all good. Didn't see him anything backstage, did we?
No.
Because we supported like Farside and
KRS.
One, and we actually saw them, chilled with them. But Ghostface didn't see him. I remember seeing him getting out of the bus when we were upstairs. That's as far as sort of. So anyway, we're happy, right? We're buzzing. So we're getting lit, super big lit. And then he goes, oh, does anyone know the lyrics to this song? And I didn't. Oh, everyone's going, Rick, get up. And I was like, I don't, it was the ODB verse.
Right.
One of the songs, and I was going, oh, and I was off me lips, and I was going, I don't know it, man. People were like, get up, Rick. And I went, no, man. They're like, get up. And I got on stage, and I went, everyone went, way. And I went, way. And Ghostface was like, do you know the lyrics? I went, no. He went, well, just try now. And I went in his ear, and I went, oh, and I made them up. I did the first few. And he went, no, man, you don't want to off your lips? And I went, I know. And that was it. And I went, way, thank you. We've been great. Got back down.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, you know, that's, well, it is what it is.
It's mad, actually, because like, there's a gimmick that Ghostface does, which is that specific gimmick. And I remember at Boom Bap Festival the year before then, he was riding with that gimmick. And BVA from Four Owls, he asked him to do it, and he nailed it.
Right.
He knew all the lyrics, and it was the ODB verse.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, he must do this thing for his performances to do, get everyone to do the ODB verse.
Got you.
I remember BVA doing it.
I remember the first two lines and I went blank. I
remember BVA doing it as well. I could do it sober, but not what we'd done.
What we just did.
No.
Could you talk through your latest album now, today?
Yeah, so the second album I did was, it was a continuation on from the first album, as far as like the same mentality, the same work ethic, the same sort of creative structure. But instead of just jumping straight in to do a second album, I took time out because I knew that to create an album, you need to have stuff to talk about, so you're not just relaying the same information and hashing over old ground. So I took about 3 years and just gradually built little ideas bit by bit to the point where I had enough substance to start making the third album. But in the process, I mean, I went through like maybe a couple of really hard relapses. A breakup. I didn't get to see my kid for a bit. A lot of shit really, but this all builds up to creating an album, as opposed to just when the first album's finished, straight away write the second album. I like to take some time out, which is kind of what I'm doing now, mm-hmm. in between the second album and third album. That's Santa Tramp. Big up Santa Tramp. I'm glad he's still alive. But Santa Tramp 2, actually. Santa Tramp 1 died about 5 years ago. Rest in peace, Santa Tramp 1. It's like Simpsons, Santa's little helper and shit. So I give him 50 quid. About 6 months ago.
What, that guy?
He was off my lips on coke. I gave him 50 quid. He went, are you a family man, sir? I went, yeah. He went, are they angels? I went, yep. Anyways, back to the story. So I like to have a bit of time off between albums because I like to actually think about creating an album as opposed to just continuation. So the album today, it's all very specific as far as like a topic. So there's no track on there that's not like sort of, it doesn't have like a reason, it's just rhyming. Everything's very much specific as far as different topics. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I work as far as like, every track has to be individual and it has to be about something. It's not just rhyming for the sake of rhyming.
Yeah.
I try and talk about aspects of my life. I try and isolate that aspect and really go in hard and try and get to the bottom of it. A lot of soul searching, a lot of just trying to work out different parts of me and questioning why and how, you know. It's, as much as for the audience, it's for me as well. Again, it's just trying to fucking figure everything out on the fly.
Great. Since jumping into hip hop, making your albums, what has been the biggest challenge?
Coping with my addictions, drinking drugs. That's the biggest challenge because I feel as a creative person, it's very hard to get that sort of that release, that feeling without being under the influence. I've tried, and unfortunately, I can't seem to get that creative flair without having something, you know, like a substance, and it's very hard to balance that. So, you know, you can say, okay, I'm just gonna drink a little bit and then try and write, or I'm just gonna drink a little bit and then write about it or something. But it can get very messy. You can get carried away in the process. So, I would say, yeah, the most difficult part is trying to find a balance with the underlying addictions that I have.
Going on from your latest album, in one or two, three words, I'm going to shout out your track names and you tell me about them tracks.
Okay.
Sellouts.
New York influenced, Joy Division sample.
Game winner.
Basketball, NBA, Schoolyard, NBA Jam.
Skit one
on the first album. Why don't you drink more alcohol related shit? Skit one on the second album was more computer game samples.
Cool. Castle of Illusions.
Subliminal diss track. Annoyed at people wanting to punch someone.
Addicted.
Alcohol fueled. Sad song.
Problems.
Another alcohol fueled sad song.
Video soon.
Video coming soon, yeah. We're editing the video for Problems right now.
Cool. The War Zone.
The Warp Zone.
The Warp Zone, sorry.
Influenced by computer games. And me and Rick just flying around on the metro with a metro pass, doing whatever the fuck we want.
I've seen the future.
Orwell, Aldous Huxley, conspiracy theories, David Icke.
Today.
Uplifting, positive mental attitude, exploration, Japan.
Nice. Is there a section in a movie that freaked you out, you remember it for all the wrong reasons, or a section that you'd rather not watch again?
So I think I've spoke about this one.
Yeah.
Do you want me to roll with the same one?
Yeah, go with the same one, mate.
All right, so when I was a kid, I was an avid horror movie fan, and I would just watch any horror movie. I made friends with the staff in the shop, so they let me just rent any movie out for free. 18s, when I was like fucking 8 or 9, just was a weird kid. I was obsessed with horror, blood and shit. So Child's Play has always moved me. Child's Play, out of all the other shit, It was specifically the scene where Chucky comes alive for the first time. For half the movie, you don't know whether he's you know, alive or not, or any of that shit. You never see him. But when the mother of the main character, Andy, she actually she realizes that the kid's not lying and the fucking doll's doing the shit because there's no batteries in the doll. So she takes him over to the fire and she's got a big, huge fireplace. And she's got this doll and she's like, I know you can talk. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
And she goes, if you don't fucking talk, I'm going to throw you in the fire. And he just comes alive. He goes, you fucking slut, you fucking bitch, I'll fucking kill you. And I'm just like, I'm still traumatized. And he bites the woman and he gets away. And I'm just like, no, the first one. That's the first one. If anyone's out there, watch the scene where Chucky first comes alive. It's really good. I mean, the animatronics and stuff, brilliant. But yeah. That really freaks me out, that scene. I love it, but it's very dark. And Brad Dourif, who plays the voice of Chucky, he nails it. Like, the anger and the venom when he's talking, it's incredible, next level.
That's great, man, great. I mean, while we're here, I'm going to ask Rick the same thing.
What?
Ooh. Anything that springs to mind?
I didn't like horrors. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
I didn't like horrors, but my older sister was obsessed with him, so it was Freddy Krueger for me.
For
all the wrong reasons, this is totally different. Because I didn't like horror, so I was like, ooh, scary.
Yeah.
But there's a bit on Dream Warriors 3 where there's a nurse takes a lad in a room and she takes her top off. You see her boobs and that, just before she turns into Freddy. So I would pause it on the boobs and just be like,
nice.
I'd be like, alright, I like it.
I remember that scene. I remember that scene well.
That's how I'm living.
Nice.
But then didn't the boobs turn into Freddy?
She turned into Freddy, yeah, like straight away.
Because he's touching the boobs and then they turn,
instant turn off.
Oh, you've got to pause it shit hot, otherwise
you
ruin your
wank.
Right? Yeah.
What?
No.
Gilly man, I appreciate you coming down, doing this interview.
No ball, mate.
Rick, I appreciate you coming down also. Great to meet you both. I've got a lot of mutual friends. Kind of wasn't the first time we met, if you know what I mean.
Aye, man.
Pleasure,
mate.
Big props to you, and I wish you both well with your future success.
Cheers, man.
And future albums, and best of luck.
Yeah.
Cheers, bro.
Cheers.